You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
So the signature accomplishment of the Obama administration while in office was, at least on foreign policy, the nuclear deal with Iran. Then the Trump administration undid it. And now the Biden administration says they want to get back into it, unsurprisingly, since they see themselves as kind of a continuation of what Obama was doing on foreign policy to some degree, and they have some of the same people involved. Except now the U.S. and Iran are in this kind of weird dance with each other, where though it seems like both sides want to get back into the nuclear deal, they don't really talk about it directly, sort of, and nobody is really doing the first thing that you need to do to get the negotiation started. It's a very confusing, weird situation. Well, today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, we're going to break it down. We're going to explain to you why the U.S. and Iran haven't just gotten back in the nuclear deal, and what happens in the coming years, we think, anyway, in U.S. and Iran nuclear negotiations. I'm Zach Beecham, here, as always, with Jen Williams and Alex Ward.
Hey.
So your question really is, what's the deal?
What's the deal with the Iran deal? Yes. Yes. Jerry Seinfeld.
What's the deal?
And are they ever, ever, ever getting back together?
We're now mixing, like, not only mixing pop culture metaphors, but mixing eras, right? Like mid-2010s Taylor Swift is not 90s Seinfeld airplane food routines.
It's a pandemic. There are no rules. It's fine.
Are we sure about that?
Yes, absolutely. 100%. It's anarchy.
I would totally go to a concert where Jerry Seinfeld opened for Taylor Swift.
You know, like, weird things happen now, and it's entirely possible that something like that does occur.
What's the deal with record rights?
Okay. Actually, now I want to redo this entire episode about the Taylor Swift re-recording Fearless.
Sold. Sold.
Because I have really strong feelings about it.
Okay. However, that is not the conversation we're having today.
No, I understand. I understand that we're talking about something very, very, very important.
Arms control. Yes.
Nuclear negotiations in the United States and Iran. Really big deal, obviously, since the status of nuclear weapons anywhere is a bit of a touchy subject, let alone in the Middle East. Alex, where are the two sides at right now? Why is this impasse, well, such an impasse?
So both sides are on polar opposite views on how to move forward. The issue here is sequencing, right? Who moves first? So for the Biden administration, simply put, they want Iran to come back into compliance with the Iran deal before the U.S. lifts sanctions. And it's true that Iran is out of compliance with the terms of the deal. Very basically, one of the issues here is that there were caps on how much uranium Iran can enrich. They've surpassed that caps in an effort to pressure the U.S. to come back into the deal that it left in 2018. And so the U.S. is saying, you come back under those caps, we'll lift the sanctions. Iran says, no. You, America, left the deal, and so it's your responsibility to lift the sanctions that Trump reimposed, and then we'll come back into compliance. And so they've just been in this dance saying, no, you move first. No, you move first. And it's done for myriad reasons. I think there's a genuine sense of grievance in Tehran that the U.S. did leave the deal, and so they don't need to go first, that it's America's responsibility to show that it actually wants to be a responsible member of the pact. And on top of that, Iran also has its own domestic politics, right? It doesn't want to look like it's caving to America again, in a sense. That was a major criticism in Iran after the regime made the deal with Obama. They felt like, oh, Iran gave up too much. And in the U.S., we have to acknowledge that there is a 50-50 Senate, that there is, you know, split politics. You have Biden wanting to promote unity on the Iran deal or just in foreign policy in general. And so you have him saying, look, we're basically taking a hard line here, right? We're not going to give up anything at all until Iran gets back into compliance. And there are good reasons for that as well, beyond the domestic politics, which is, look, why enter a deal that Iran is violating, right? And it is. It is not abiding by the terms of it. So we've been in this weird dance really for a while, this first month, but that has just briefly started to change.
I think both sides in some ways have a point, right? Iran certainly has a point in the sense that in return for doing, you know, taking the steps that it did, including adhering to those caps on all kinds of things, not just uranium enrichment, but plutonium, all sorts of stuff, allowing in inspectors and really kind of like strict inspection regime from international inspectors. In return for doing that, they were supposed to get essentially economic relief. Those sanctions were supposed to come off, and they did briefly. And that was to enable Iran's economy to start getting out from underneath the kind of crippling sanctions it's been under, and to enable countries in Europe and elsewhere around the world to start doing business with Iran again, and for Iran to actually have very specific, clear economic benefits in response, in return for taking these steps. That was only just starting to happen. Businesses, particularly in Europe, were only just starting to kind of make inroads toward doing concrete business deals with Iran when the Trump administration pulled out of the deal and reimposed those sanctions. So in Iran's eyes, it's like, well, this time you have to go first. Like, you have to lift the sanctions so that we know this is actually going to be a thing this time, even though, yes, the Obama administration did lift the sanctions initially. So, you know, but they're saying, like, look, like, prove it. Show some good faith here. And then on the other side, it is also the case that not only has Iran started, you know, breaching the terms of the deal, it's also done other things like encouraging militia groups that it supports and in some cases directs in Iraq to launch attacks on U.S. troops and allied forces in Iraq, and doing various other things that are like really provocative and in some cases deadly. And so, you know, the Biden administration also in the midst of that doesn't want to be like, okay, and we're also going to lift a bunch of sanctions on you. You know, they don't want to, I think, you know, for the reasons Alex noted, they don't want to be seen as just completely caving to Iran. So you're in this kind of classic standoff situation.
Those are all like good reasons. Like, they make sense to me on like the face of them. But when you take a step back, it all feels almost kind of childish. We have two countries whose leadership currently agrees that an agreement would be in both of their best interests and would probably be in most of the world's best interests. And it seems like it wouldn't be that hard to figure out some way to work out the sequencing if they could plan some kind of direct pattern with each other, right? You know, one side announces, we will do this in 30 days if the other side joins us. And then they say, we will do our part in this 30-day window too. And then, yay, everybody's back in the nuclear deal. And my guess is, I don't know if it'll be something exactly like that, but none of these barriers to me sound insuperable. Like, it seems like there'll be a process for getting the sequencing down that the two sides have worked out with each other. And indeed, you're already seeing some signs that there will be some kind of negotiated process that'll get things back on track. That's a recent proposal to have Iran sit down with a group of international powers, formerly the P5 plus one, but now the P4 plus one, because Iran doesn't want the U.S. to actually be there as a full member. And this is what I mean about childish, right? They want the U.S. to be there, but not count them in the P5 plus one grouping.
The P5, meaning the five permanent members of the Security Council, U.S., UK, France, China, Russia, and the plus one is Germany. So they want to take the U.S. out of that officially.
It's like, it's very silly, right? And it to me illustrates both that a lot of these disputes, some of them are actually quite significant, and we'll talk about them a bit more in the second half. But the things that look like really serious barriers right now can be worked out if these two sides cave on some of the symbolism of it, which seems like something that they can manage to do.
I mean, it's silly and it's not. It's not in the sense, because Iran was pretty embarrassed by what happened in 2018 when Trump withdrew. Like, Hassan Rouhani, the president and the supreme leader and a bunch of other Iranian officials stake their reputations on this deal, for better or worse. And it looked like it, and for them, it ended up being worse. All the criticism they received of, oh, you guys caved to the U.S., you'll look like fools on the international stage, those criticisms land harder. And so this is like, you know, round two of a really contentious thing. I don't blame the Iranians for being very skeptical and you know, wanting to move very slowly through this process again and getting assurances. And I don't blame the U.S. for not trusting Iran for a second as to, you know, if the U.S. were to lift sanctions first, then Iran may not come back into compliance. The other reason we're just seeing why this is slow is how technical this is, right? I mean, again, Iran is enriched uranium. It's adding materials to nuclear sites. It is gaining more nuclear knowledge, right, in its own among its own team members, and it's curtailing inspector access from the IAEA and elsewhere. So even if today the U.S. and Iran said, let's move forward, it would take a really long time for Iran to go back into compliance with the terms of the deal, right? Removing centrifuges, low level of uranium enrichment, dismantling of certain nuclear sites, allowing inspectors back in, and having those inspectors verify that Iran is in compliance. So this is not only just sequencing, but it's timing here. And it looks like now that there will be an informal meeting between all the members that you described, and I'm sure they'll be able to hash this out. I mean, experts I speak to assume that we will get to yes, but it's just going to take longer. And really, I think it just comes down to general, you know, mistrust between the two countries, which is warranted completely, and then also just the politics in each country's situations.
Yeah, I think that there's the point about timing is also really important, in that there's an Iranian internal deadline coming up, which is the June presidential election.
Yeah.
Hassan Rouhani, the Iranian president, is term limited out. So he's not going to be able to run for another term, obviously. But that means somebody new is going to come on the scene, or potentially someone from the old Ahmadinejad days. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is a former Iranian president and a nuclear hardliner. It is unclear who is going to end up winning this election. Like, it's just from what I've read, it's no one has an obvious sense of who the one candidate is going to be. But in the recent parliamentary elections, the hardliners, who are most hostile to the deal internally, did quite well. So there's a decent chance that another hardliner will win in June the presidency. And in the Iranian system, it's like not really a democracy. Okay, scratch that. It is not a democracy. but there are elections internally, and the president who is elected has some significant powers in the conduct of foreign affairs. So Rouhani could spearhead something like the nuclear deal, and the new president could have a significant role in torpedoing whatever the negotiations are, throwing a monkey wrench into it. So you can read this one of two ways, right? Like, one, they need to do this fast or else there's a decent chance it fails. Or two, this looming deadline is going to get the two sides to try to get pushed past these symbolic reputational concerns faster and try to get something done relatively immediately.
I'd say there's also an additional kind of pressure deadline happening that's a little more amorphous, but arguably even more pressing, which is the fact that they are suffering hardcore from the combination of bad economic management, crushing economic sanctions, and, you know, a global pandemic that has cratered, you know, their economy and most economies around the world, and trying to address, you know, the pandemic in their country, getting vaccines, things like that, right? So there's a confluence of factors that, you know, together are really putting pressure on Iran's leaders to get this sanctions relief, like, yesterday. Like, we need this now. And, you know, it's understandable, right? And the Biden administration is doing a review on kind of broader sanctions policy, kind of trying to make sure that sanctions, even the ones they want to keep on, aren't, you know, doing too much economic harm to the people in those countries, which is kind of not the point of sanctions, right? You don't want to hurt the actual people in the country. You want to target the leaders who are doing bad policies to induce them to change those policies, ideally. And there are concerns, you know, some degree that are played up by the Iranian government on purpose for political reasons, but also some legitimate concerns that economic sanctions are hurting their ability to effectively address a public health crisis, the pandemic. So I think that's a huge impetus that you can't really overlook in this.
I mean, from a certain point of view, this all kind of sounds optimistic. And this is all, you know, cards on the table. My point of view, it all sounds kind of optimistic. Not the economic gloom and doom part that Jen was just describing. The pandemic in general is very bad. I want to be clear that my position is the pandemic and ensuing economic disaster is bad.
So brave, Zach. So brave.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, I'm a real truth teller. No, it seems to me, as someone who thinks the nuclear deal was broadly a good agreement, that it's very likely that it'll come back into force. But not everybody thinks that, and not everybody is so sanguine about the long-term situation between the United States and Iran. And we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to explore those topics. Like, just what does the future hold post this nuclear impasse for the United States and Iran?
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prof G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prof G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prof G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We've been talking about the U.S.-Iran nuclear standoff kind of thing. We ended on an uncharacteristically positive note for worldly, or what I, you know, passes for in my mind uncharacteristically positive, thinking that it's quite likely that the current strange standoff between the United States and Iran gets resolved. But not everybody thinks that's such a good idea, right, Jen? There are still a pretty significant number of critics of the nuclear deal who think that the U.S. would be better off if it just stayed out, regardless of what Biden wants.
Even Biden himself has kind of acknowledged that there were some holes or, areas in the original deal that could have been stronger. The Obama administration would and has argued that this was the strongest deal they could get, and that's the deal that they got. There are very specific concerns. These were concerns that were highlighted by the Trump administration in their argument for why they were withdrawing from the deal, I think to various degrees of believability, why they wanted to actually do that. I think some of it was just Trump wanting to undo something that Obama did personally. But some of the issues in particular were like the sunset clauses, which essentially, without getting into all the technical details, basically many of the different kind of limitations that were put on Iran's nuclear program, the enrichment, the facilities, plutonium, all kinds of stuff like that, were supposed to last for varying degrees of time. So after, you know, 10 years, after 15 years, after 20 years, different things had kind of end dates. That's a normal feature in most arms control agreements. It's not actually that strange. It's, you know, part of the idea is that you, one, at least move, you know, the goalpost farther away, right? You at least buy yourself some time. The point is that by doing that, in that time span, in those years, the idea is that you start using this as like a platform on which to build more cooperation and further agreements and more kind of trust and confidence building measures, so that eventually you develop stronger things. And then when it comes to the deadline, you have, you know, you could say, let's renegotiate or let's extend this for 5 years or whatever. But a lot of people who were critics of the deal saw these sunset clauses as essentially saying, we're just kicking the can down the road. We're setting up Iran to just be able to do whatever it wants as soon as these lift. That wasn't totally accurate. There were some conditions in the deal that actually would remain in perpetuity, including some stuff to dealing with like inspectors still being allowed in, things like that. But, you know, there were legitimate criticisms that, okay, this should be a forever thing. Iran didn't want to agree to that, though. They were not going to say that we will always have restrictions on our nuclear development, in part because right now we can't fuel our nuclear reactors without getting the fuel we need from Russia because we can't develop this stuff. Well, we don't want to be relying on Russia forever. So we'd like to at some point be able to, you know, make our own fuel to fuel our nuclear reactors for energy purposes. So, you know, they had legitimate reasons to say that as well. But The other kind of big criticism was that the agreement doesn't actually address other related issues that are really big problems with Iran's behavior and activities in the region, including very specifically its ballistic missile program, which is what you use to deliver ostensibly a nuclear weapon. So there are a lot of people that are like, literally, how can you deal with its nuclear program and not address the super extremely closely related ballistic missile program? Now, Iran said, well, because we're not going to talk about that, that's off the table. And the Obama administration said, fair enough. Let's try to get at least the nuclear thing done. And it also, you know, by lifting sanctions, opened up economic opportunity for Iran. And people were concerned that that would give them more money to be able to sponsor terrorist groups in the region, et cetera, et cetera. So those were kind of the main concerns. And if we, you know, get back in the deal, those concerns don't go away, right? If they go back to the original deal, it's that original deal. It's not a stronger deal. And that's kind of where the tension is right now. Like, do they just start over? Do they just get back in the deal and then try to negotiate, you know, maybe an addendum that addresses some of those other things? And that's kind of the big kind of tension right now.
I mean, the Biden administration's been pretty clear about what they want to do here, right? They've been saying that they want to put the nuclear issue, you know, quote unquote, in a box. Essentially the same argument from the Obama years, which was, if you want to talk about the missile program, if you want to talk about proxies, if you want to talk about terrorism and all those other, you know, horrid things, it is easier to make deals on that and easier to make progress on that stuff if the nuclear issue is solved, right? Because if Iran were to obtain a nuclear weapon, and we should say here, they continue to deny that they seek one, but they are close to acquiring one at this moment, a few months away, if they were, in fact, inclined to do so. You know, the Biden team, the Obama folks would say and have said, the second Iran, you know, has this breakout moment when they get the bomb, that is the overlying concern. Everything else just kind of like doesn't really matter. And now you are enemies really fighting each other. And we have to remember what it really felt like in the Obama years, whether you bought into it or not. There were people who genuinely felt like there was only two options here. It was either we strike a nuclear deal or it's war, because Iran was nearing a weapon, you know, it was nearing getting one.
Capability to get one.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is where there's still a lot of folks in the Biden team come from. Now, they have clearly moved a bit to the Republican side here. And in all of their rhetoric, they're saying, look, this is just the nuclear stuff, but we are going to negotiate on missiles, on terrorism, on proxies, on all, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is, I think, both rhetorical, like just to kind of stop criticism, but I think it is also serious. I think they have noticed that it is getting harder and harder to stop Iran from doing things. They've, you know, some of its proxies have attacked American troops in Iraq and elsewhere in recent weeks and months and years and going back for a while. But even so, like, this is now a larger issue set. And then finally, I think the Biden folks have made it pretty clear. I remember reporting on, you know, what Biden was going to do on foreign policy before he came into office. And the Middle East in general didn't come up like at all. And so part of this is, I think Biden wants to solve the Middle East problem outside of, you know, Yemen is one. The other one is Iran's nuclear program and also just the arms control issues that were outstanding, such as the one with Russia. So by getting the nuclear deal, you make a massive Middle East problem go away and you solve another arms control crisis. And then you can deal on the side more with Iran on those other issues that we've been talking about. So I really think that's really what's at stake here. And I think Iran also wants to get into the deal mostly just to get the money back.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to hear you describing the administration's rhetoric as moving sort of to the right in this general conversation, because it strikes me that the Trump years are pretty strong vindication of the basic case for the Iran nuclear deal, in that we could see a test of what happened when Iran got out of the deal and what happened to their behavior. And it was, you know, largely what proponents of the nuclear deal predicted would happen, right? Iran, they didn't go for a nuclear weapon right away, but they started breaking out of the limits that were imposed on them, which were pretty strict in terms of things like uranium production, the access they had to grant inspectors to make sure they weren't building a bomb, right? The provisions of the deal itself, if you look at it as an arms control agreement, were really strict. It would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for them to pursue a bomb covertly under the terms of the agreement as it was structured. And they started doing things that could bring them a lot closer to what I think Alex correctly described as a pretty scary status quo ex ante, both during the Obama and Bush years. You know, at the end of the Bush administration, there's a report that the Israelis wanted to strike Iran and then were turned down by the U.S. government that didn't want to provide them logistical and political support. That's how concerned people were about the actual prospect of war, like a real regional war over the topic of Iran's nuclear program. And at the same time, right, there hasn't been a significant downgrading or decreasing in Iran's regional malfeasance, right? Like part of the case against the nuclear deal is, well, you're giving them resources to do the stuff that they're going to do otherwise. Well, Trump got out of the deal and Iran has, and the U.S. is still currently out of the nuclear agreement, and Iran is still engaging in all sorts of different problematic behaviors. Those didn't stop during the deal. They didn't stop when we were out of it. They didn't stop before it, right? It's there's a delinkage between some of Iran's strategic regional objectives, things that it wants to accomplish in a place like Yemen or Syria, and what it hopes to accomplish through the nuclear program. And trying to solve those all in one fell swoop seems very difficult to me. One, and two, it doesn't seem necessary if you have a successful agreement that takes out what is probably the most concerning element of Iran's behavior, which is introducing another nuclear power into the Middle East if they chose to go down that route, either provoking some kind of war or prompting a nuclear arms race and other countries starting to nuclearize in that region, which is like super bad news. So no matter what, things get scary in a world where there aren't restrictions on their nuclear activity. It just seems it seems like what we've seen recently is more vindication of the idea that, you know, the pre-2018 status quo was a lot better than the pre-nuclear deal status quo, or post-nuclear deal status quo, for that matter.
I think there's also just kind of a broader issue here, though, beyond the specific terms of the deal. Looking at it more holistically, one of the main kind of criticisms was that the Obama administration, just gave up too much. That they overlooked a lot of things. And there's a lot of evidence that they did that on purpose, that they looked the other way on a lot of things that Iran was doing, including, you know, credible reports that the members of the Obama administration, because they wanted to get the Iran deal done, basically blocked and undermined a multi-year huge DEA operation to essentially interdict Hezbollah's international crime syndicate and stop it from earning, you know, up to $1 billion from literally like drug trafficking around the world and tracing that. They have traced that directly to senior leaders in Hezbollah and Iranian backers. The Obama administration also did some other kind of, you could argue, it was a little shady stuff on the side, like secretly kind of going around this promise they made to Congress to not let Iran ever have access to the U.S. financial system. They kind of said that Iran could really quickly, just for a few minutes, change some currency in a U.S. bank because that was part of what they were trying to give Iran, right? Like, the way the Obama administration went about it, I think there are some legitimate criticisms there that they wanted the deal so badly that they did give up a lot. And again, you can argue that that's okay, that that's how deals get done, right? Like that the nuclear program is the biggest thing and that it was worth making those sacrifices to get there. That's the essential argument they did make. But I do think it's, when you're looking now at the situation and you're comparing, you know, especially since some of the same figures are involved and now in the Biden administration that were involved originally, I think there is a genuine concern and it's to some degree warranted that that's going to happen again, that we're going to continue to overlook things like U.S. forces being attacked in Iraq by groups that are aligned or directed by Iran, overlooking other, you know, issues that may not even be in the headlines, but that are happening to get back to the deal. I think that's one of the big concerns, and I think it's valid.
I think it's just important to, on your personnel issue, just for folks who may not be aware, like the two original people that got the ball rolling on making the Iran deal happen were Jake Sullivan, who at the time was at the State Department and is now the National Security Advisor, and Bill Burns, who was a higher level State Department official and is now on his way to becoming the CIA director. He had his confirmation hearing on Wednesday, and he's going to sail through, it looks like. And then you had John Kerry, who finally, you know, made it happen. Now he's working on climate change issues, so, you know, I don't think he'll be involved. But like, these same people can talk to Biden, and, you know, surely Biden will reach out to them, Sullivan more than most. and get his thoughts and their thoughts on, you know, what they should do, how they should move forward. And you have Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, who's still there. And he's the one who's been signaling that Iran is open to having informal meetings. So, like, the same actors are around. Tony Blinken, my goodness, Secretary of State, who was also very close to Biden. All these folks, right? So, like, it's the same cadre. This is why there's so much worry about what comes next, is what will this team realize their errors, let's say, or at least maybe... Do they now feel like, in retrospect, they could have gotten more? Do they push for that? That, I think, is part of also why they're having the hard line. Or do they kind of, as I was describing earlier, think, you know, we want out of the Middle East. I mean, I think the Biden team has been pretty clear that their regional priorities are Asia 1, Europe 2, Western Hemisphere 3, which puts the Middle East somewhere, at least, you know, at most 4. So by getting the nuclear deal, do you just move that off the agenda and move forward? That is a possibility. That could be something that they're thinking about as well. And this is what they're wrestling with. But we also have to think it's not just policy here that matters. Of course, this is a policy. But there's a legacy issue here, too, on both sides. Like, if you're the Obama team or the Biden team now, you want this to stick. You want this to work. You want your place in foreign policy history to be good. And on top of that, of course, you want this to be a successful policy for the region of the United States. And then if you're Hassan Rouhani and Javad Zarif, like, you also perhaps want this to live and show that it could work and that there is a diplomatic path of working with the U.S. where, you know, you don't give up everything, but you help yourself in the process and everyone gets a little bit of something. Like, there's a lot of reputation management going on here, too. But the hope is, one, you know, that you still put that nuclear issue in a box, quote unquote, and then you can go work on myriad other things that matter.
Yeah, it's also... kind of getting ground up, okay, not kind of, like a lot getting ground up in the partisan meat grinder in Washington right now. It's not a surprise to worldly listeners that the extreme partisanship of the American political system is affecting the way that foreign policy is being conducted and the structuring the conversation surrounding foreign policy. But almost no topic in international affairs is more polarized on party lines than the Iran nuclear deal. And this isn't just because it's a signature Obama achievement, though that's obviously a large part of it. Isn't just because Trump pulling out of it was one of his big concrete things in foreign policy, though that's also a big part of it. It's that it has polarized the entire foreign policy commentariat, establishment, intelligentsia, the blob, as Obama's former advisor Ben Rhodes memorably put it once, along partisan lines, right? The blob, in theory, the foreign policy establishment in Washington is nonpartisan, but the Iran issue has proven extremely divisive. To the extent that there's currently a Biden nominee named Colin Call, who is a leading advocate for the nuclear deal, to my mind, one of the smarter and more thoughtful public voices on this issue. And he's running into a real buzzsaw of Republican opposition in the Senate. He's nominated for a high-ranking post in the Department of Defense. And it doesn't seem like, based on current reporting, that Alex would know more about this than I did, so he can expand on this, that he's going to get blocked, because it doesn't look like there's going to be a Democratic defection, or at least there's no evidence of that yet. There still could be, and Democrats control the Senate. But the degree to which Republicans are seeming to start to line up against Call is indicative of the way in which party politics are shaping Washington's response, just as much as internal disagreements between Iranian doves and hawks are shaping the way that Rouhani and his team are approaching the negotiations right now.
Yeah, just what's happening is Call is up for Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon. It's the third highest civilian position. Senator Jim Inhofe, who's the top Republican on that committee, has basically said, like, if Biden puts up anyone who is a defender of the Iran nuclear deal, like, I'm going to either push back or oppose. And he said that, and he wrote that in an op-ed. He's been clear about that. So here comes Colin Call, who's going to have his hearing on March 4th. And Inhofe is already saying he's got concerns. On top of that, also, that Colin was a top Middle East official at the Pentagon when ISIS resurged in Iraq. So, look, I'm not sure that he's going to have his nomination tanked. That said, it could be pretty close, right? And you don't really want, especially like a number three position at the Pentagon, to be... to go in with like a partisan vote, right? These are normally the like 80 to 20 and above kind of votes. You don't want it to be, you know, 51-49 or 51-50 or whatever. Like, you want this to be a fairly bipartisan confirmation vote. And look, Colin is about as vocal a proponent of the deal and a critic of the Trump administration's handling of with maximum pressure and all that as anyone out there. And so I would say right now, what we've been seeing so far in this nomination process are sort of two things: that anyone that Biden puts forward has to be a staunch China hawk on almost on every facet, and they have to at least be rhetorically open to saying, yeah, there's more we can do with Iran. The question is, can Colin do that when he's been so on the record about this is the way in a sort of Mandalorian style, making his case?
To be fair, the Obama administration isn't completely blameless when it comes to why things got so partisan around the Iran nuclear deal, right?
Yeah.
They launched a massive political comms propaganda, you know, push to get this deal through because a lot of people, especially Republicans, but also people who are traditionally fairly nonpartisan, had real concerns. And the Obama administration pushed really, really hard through the media, through experts at think tanks, to really quell those concerns. And in some cases, to, you know, paint people who had legitimate concerns saying, well, you know, maybe we should talk about this. Maybe we should think about getting some stronger things here as, you know, trying to sabotage diplomacy and things like that. So, which, you know, of course, that's, it's not like saying that's a bad thing, right? That's how politics are done, right? If you want to get something done and through and approved, you need to convince people that it's a great idea and try to, you know, get people who think it's not a good idea to not be so loud. I'm not saying that they were wrong to do that, but I do think, you know, it was a very big political win that Obama was trying to push through. And a lot of people ended up, you know, even if you had legitimate concerns about the deal, kind of getting pushed into, oh, so you want to go to war with Iran? No, not saying that. I'm just saying there's some concerns here. So, you know, I think a lot of people might not remember how contentious the Iran deal was. And getting to it was a huge political fight. So, you know, to be fair, that was the thing that happened. And I think we're still seeing the legacy of that.
I don't know who we're being fair to here, right, under these circumstances. There was like this PR campaign was a reaction to what was essentially a preemptive assault on the idea of negotiating with Iran that began not only like before Obama was president and even during the interim nuclear agreement before the final agreement was signed. You had people saying on the Republican side that this was worse than Munich, worse than giving up the Sudetenland to Hitler. Right. Like, it's the amount of hyperbole and bad faith attacks on like even the process of negotiating at the time was pretty extreme. Right. And then a lot of the criticism centered on things that the deal didn't do rather than what it actually did. There were distortions of the provisions and very little engagement with the details of it as an arms control agreement. And a lot of it getting ground and pulled into a broader partisan discourse. It strikes me not as a reflection so much of specific strategic choices by like Obama administration actors or even like particular Republicans so much as the way in which Iran specifically gets brought into a kind of Middle East politics culture war, which is a real problem in Washington. The Israel-Palestine debate also gets sucked into this, probably even worse to a degree, except that support for Israel is bipartisan and remains so currently, so it's a little bit attenuated in some ways in the D.C. specific discourse. But in general, there's a way in which Middle East policy conversations, more so than almost any other foreign policy debate, gets bound up in the partisan identity conflicts that shape the way that Washington functions currently. And that, I think, has manifested in a very weird and very emotional debate around Iran that is detached from not only the stakes of the various different issues at play in terms of the U.S. relationship with Iran, but also the like actual policy details in a lot of ways that I find very frustrating whenever I attempt to engage with it. And that's part of how somebody like Colin Call, who again really is a he's very liberal, and I'm sure Republicans don't like that, but he's an excellent track record, is a really smart guy. He's not hyperbolic in his criticisms. I find his public writing to be very strong, especially compared to what you often read from people with government ambitions who are very bland in terms of what they have to say. Someone like that becoming a lightning rod to me is suggestive of there being broader problems in the nature of the discourse surrounding the issue than it is indicative of a real problem on the merits.
Yeah. So just to be clear who I was being fair to, it was people who had legitimate concerns and raised very serious issues, both, you know, before and after the nuclear deal, and who were essentially targeted for like reputational, you know, being skewered for their reputation unfairly as, you know, trying to sabotage something rather than being just like fairly nonpartisan analysts who were just raising legitimate questions. It was something that happened pretty regularly, including I could cite specific examples that, again, it's politics. It's hardball. To be fair, it wasn't Republicans only just playing hardball on the nuclear deal and making it political. The Obama administration played hardball right back.
I always felt that there have been like four categories of people who view the Iran deal. And this is sort of from the Obama era to now. And it's sort of like starting from the left here. It's those who felt it was the best deal you could get at the time. Moving a bit more to the right, it was, well, you probably could have gotten a little bit more. Then it was the folks saying, no, this deal is bad for these policy reasons. And you had folks saying, this is appeasement, right? And like that was the general trajectory. And I feel like the debate has effectively calcified in those two extremes. I think from the Biden folks, you're starting to hear that they're trying to move a little bit to the, well, we probably could have gotten more, but what is most realistic, especially with the timeline, with the election coming up, is just like, let's go back into this imperfect deal. Let's just calm things down, right? Things are pretty heated right now. You've got uranium enrichment going. You've got, sanctions on your country that as the pandemic runs wild, and let's just go back to where we were and let's use that as the springboard to do more things, which was the original argument, by the way. But like, that's where we're at, I think, at the moment. And that doesn't seem super controversial unless you are still in that more extreme position of, well, this is appeasement, which goes to bigger issues that we can't really discuss here, but of just like, what is America's role in the world? Where does diplomacy fit? You know, should we have any negotiations whatsoever with adversaries? And like, those are sort of deeper philosophical questions. But on the policy here, this is really just about, I think, in trying to do the easiest thing, which is go back to what we had, right? Which seems like both sides want, but moving very cautiously, and then pushing the boundaries of what's possible. I think the Biden team will have some success in getting back in. I think they might have very little success in getting more, especially when you're not seeing any bipartisan help here, right? This is really sort of one-sided. But getting back into the deal in and of itself is probably should be considered a foreign policy win and reversing what was very clearly a destructive policy from the Trump years. Because as I like to remind folks, right, the Trump team said, here are the 12 things we're going to get out of Iran by getting out of the nuclear deal, which is including proxies, missiles, et cetera. I can report safely that they are 0 for 12. So maybe it's worth going back into the deal and starting from there again and seeing what we get.
Well, 0 for 12 sounds bad. And I like, again, ending on a uncharacteristically optimistic note because, you know, you can only go up from 0 for 12, or you can only get better from here, right? So I want to thank our producer, Sophie Lalonde, for all of her hard work. I want to encourage all of you to rate, subscribe, review, etc., Worldly, wherever you get your podcast. And I also have a special request. We want your feedback, not just like we got last week on the episode format, which we loved. That was really helpful.
Thank you to everyone. We read all of your emails, even if we can't respond to all of them. Thank you. We read every single one and we really appreciate it.
So here's the request, though. We do these short episodes. You know, normally we do a shorter version of the conversation we've been having right now. But we're thinking going forward, we want to try to tackle your questions. Want to use these shorter opportunities to address issues that you, our listeners, think are interesting and important. So if you have ideas, right, you have questions you want us to answer, send us an email at worldly@vox.com and we're going to answer them. We'll talk about what you want to talk about. So send us an email at worldly@vox.com and we will see you next week.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prof G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prof G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prof G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.